Hello. First of all, I'd like to apologise for my complete lack of French. Having got that out of the way, my name's Charlie Stross, and among other things, I used to develop software. These days, I'm a science fiction writer. Now, I'm going to start by making a big assumption that everyone here thinks we know what science fiction is. We're probably all wrong, but I could be here all night if I stopped and tried to define it, because there are as many definitions of science fiction as there are readers. Let's just stop by calling it the literature of ideas and leave it at that for now. We're here, notionally, to talk about a number of themes and futures. Artificial intelligence is one of them. The singularity, a step change in the nature of the world around us, triggered by the development of artificial intelligences, a concept, incidentally, which was first named by American SF author and computer science professor Werner Vinge, is another. But I'd like to flip the subject matter on its side and start by talking about something that appears at first to be completely different. I've got this pet theory that artificial intelligences, far from being imaginary, far from being the imagined future of big corporations like IBM, have been living among us for more than 200 years now. We interact with these artificial intelligences every day. We take them for granted. And the dirty little secret underlying the information technology revolution is that they've been running it all along. Now, I realise that this requires a little bit of explanation. So let me back up and throw some buzzwords around from the world of genetics. I'm going to talk a bit about coevolution and the extended phenotype. The phenotype of an organism is its physical structure, its body plan, its shape, its tissues, the components of the organism which grow as dictated by its genes. The extended phenotype is a slightly less familiar concept. It was coined by evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins, and it covers the complete package of physiology and behaviour that arise from the interaction between an organism's genes and its environment. We human beings like to think of ourselves as being very individual, very quirky, very self-directed. But in reality, the one thing we can say about our extended phenotype is that it makes us incredibly plastic. We are very easy to train. We don't always play out the same way. If you take an organism like a cat or a dog, you can find certain behaviours which are pretty much common to all of them if they have the physical equipment to demonstrate them. Interesting trick you can play on a cat. Start tickling it along the spine, starting at the base of the tail and working towards the head. On about 50% of the cats, when you're about a third of the way up their spine, they'll start compulsively washing themselves. It's a controlled reflex. It's part of their extended phenotype. It's not part of their physical body any more than a beaver's dam is part of a beaver's physical body, but it's definitely dictated by their genes. Now, the interesting thing about human beings is that our extended phenotype doesn't always play out the same way. Our behaviour doesn't always emerge from our genes. Bits of it can be suppressed or modified by environmental pressures, such as induction into military service or exposure to religious indoctrination. We can turn human beings into components of social machines quite easily. As a famous Jesuit said, give me a boy by seven and I'll give you the man. Now, we describe certain species of cooperative organisms, those that live in hives of genetically related individuals who take on specialised roles, as eusocial organisms. For example, ants. Ants are probably the commonest example. So are bees. These social insects live in hives, Only a few of them reproduce. All of them contribute to the good of the hive, and they adopt specialised roles. But it's not just insects who are eusocial. There are mammals. For example, the naked mole rat, a rather peculiar species of desert-dwelling rodent, is another eusocial organism. Naked mole rats exist in colonies under the Kalahari Desert. Only one or two females in a colony reproduce, and they reproduce for all. The other animals take on worker or soldier roles, as in an anthill. Sorry. Modern evolutionary theory explains eusociality in terms of selfish genes. The workers share genes with the reproductive units, the queens. They may not be reproducing, but their genes are reproduced more efficiently by contributing to the well-being of the hive. Because we humans are behaviourally plastic, we can't really be said to be true eusocial animals. A monk or a nun, for example, can come out of a monastery and raise a family. Manual labourers can go to night school and become lawyers or literary theorists. But we're very good at producing social structures that exhibit patterns of eusocial organisation, or indeed that mimic the organisation of an anthill, by imposing them on successive human units. This has been explained by some evolutionary biologists, again I'm getting back to Richard Dawkins, in terms of memes. A meme, at its simplest, is a transmissible idea. The idea of memes is itself a meme. We humans are a substrate not just for genetic replication, but for the replication and transfer of ideas. Language allows us to pass concepts around and acquire beneficial traits that are not part of our genome. A side effect of meme transmission is that we tend to generate memes that promote behaviour that furthers their own replication. A meme that can replicate efficiently is more evolutionarily adept than one that does not foster its own transmission. For example, you can consider the chain letter as a meme that is optimized for its own replication. Many religions also match the bill. For example, those that require members of a religion to indoctrinate their own children into it. Among these behavioral replicators, there's a very significant one which imposes a eusocial structure on the humans who acquire it. And the modern corporation is probably the most highly developed form of eusocial meme. From a genetic point of view, corporations are social structures that require an ever-changing group of human host organisms to fill distinct and well-differentiated roles within their structure. What makes corporations interesting is they exhibit goal-oriented behaviour. The corporation doesn't have human goals. It doesn't eat or reproduce like a mammal, but it has drives to expand, to maximise shareholder value, to profit. And these may indeed be orthogonal to or antithetical to the needs of their component humans. For example, corporations may engage in practices which damage the environment in which their own workforce live. As the makers of the film The Corporation contend, most corporations exhibit behaviour as a collective, which in an individual human would be alarming, sociopathic. Corporations aren't intrinsically good or evil, those being human traits, but they're ruthless in pursuit of their primary objectives, typically to make profits, without regard for the environment in which they operate. Corporations are superorganisms like ant colonies, and the individual organisms may have very different goals from that of a colony as a whole. And now I'm going to embarrass Richard Barbrook by quoting from his New York prophecies. The invention of computers came at an opportune moment for big business. During the first half of the 20th century, large corporations had become the dominant institutions of the American economy. When profitable, corporations replaced the indirect regulation of production by markets with direct supervision by bureaucrats. As the wage bill for white-collar employees steadily rose, businesses needed increasing amounts of equipment to raise productivity within the office. Long before the invention of a computer, corporations were running an information economy with tabulators, typewriters, and other types of office equipment. However, by the beginning of the 1950s, the mechanization of clerical labor had stalled. increases in productivity in the office were lagging well behind those in the factory. When the first computers appeared on the market, corporate managers quickly realized that the new technology offered a solution to this pressing problem. The work of large numbers of tabulator operators could now be done by a much smaller group of people using a mainframe. I'd like to steal that insight, which is quite very valuable, and reframe it in this context of eusocial organisms, which I'd like to emphasize is just me, in my capacity as a science fiction writer, flying a kite, speculating. It's what I'm paid for, after all. A corporate manager isn't an individual, but a role within the corporate structure. You don't have to go as far as Eddie Murphy in Trading Places, a comedy that played off the interchangeability of human beings with social roles. You can go back to George Bernard Shaw's Pygmalion and realise that our corporate manager isn't unique and irreplaceable to the corporation. You can take one manager and replace them with another. Or rather, you can take one person playing the role of manager and replace them with another person. They may have other social roles in society at large which are more significant to them. But while they're working for their corporation, they've got a financial duty to act in accordance with the corporation's needs. Thus, it's more accurate to say that the corporations realise that the new technology offered a better way to improve their administrative infrastructure. The corporation, in effect, has a life of its own, independent of its component members. Now, standing on the threshold of the 21st century, it's fairly clear that the huge strides in performance of information technologies that characterised the past five decades have been catalysed by corporations. In the military sphere, smart weapons and fly-by-wire fighters provided their manufacturers with enticing products to sell to their traditional clients and an opportunity for profit. In the civil sector, a Red Queen's race has been unfolding. Corporations who don't adopt automation fail to compete and fall by the wayside, while corporations supplying automation products have a marked incentive to find more and more products to supply. Thus, companies are locked into a vicious cycle of having to automate increasingly just to stay in the race. Meanwhile, the human end of the equation is weighted with a constant of de-skilling and outsourcing. One of the prerequisites for the adoption of total quality management within an organisation is the codification of all institutional knowledge required for each role in the organisation, in a form such that the human occupants can be replaced like interchangeable modules. Now I'd like to briefly go off on another tangent, back to the attractor of artificial intelligence. During the 1970s, there was a protracted debate, especially among the philosophers, around the topic of whether a machine could think. Philosopher John Searle is one of the most well-known actors on the critical side of the fence, and is best known for his Chinese Room thought experiment, in which he posed the pointed question, if it's just a set of rules for shuffling symbols, where's the intelligence? Searle's Chinese Room was, if you can imagine, a room with a very intricate set of instruction manuals shelved around it. There's a letterbox at one side and a letterbox at the other side. Someone at one side sends in a letter written in Chinese, and the purpose of the rules, the books of rules, is that a clerk working in the room with no understanding of Chinese can look at the symbols that have been passed in, carry out transformations on the symbols in accordance with the rules, and come up with another document in Chinese which can be passed out of the other letterbox. This is a fairly crude metaphor for the existence of artificial intelligence software. As Searle pointed out, if the clerk in the office doesn't speak Chinese, where's the intelligence? Now, I don't want to get into an epistemological argument at this point. Daniel Dennett and other philosophers have addressed Searle rather more competently than I could pretend to. But I think this is a classic case of failing to understand how abstraction works in information systems. The Chinese Room is not a physically embodied intelligence, but an emulated or simulated intelligence. Just as you can run an emulator for example, a Macintosh on a PC or a Unix workstation. There are corollaries to Searle's scenario which are much more disturbing. If a corporation is a eusocial organism constructed from interchangeable components capable of programmed behaviour, which is what we expect of a company which is fully total quality management compliant, then we can speculate that the endpoint for the corporation, especially one that exists to produce and process intellectual property, is one that has eliminated the human component entirely. It's an artificial intelligence, or at least an artificial organism, and in human terms, such organisms are sociopaths. Now, I thought at this point I should perhaps summarise my long and rambling thought train. So I've got a number of points, which are: corporations are legally constituted as individuals, but they have their own goals and drives which aren't compatible all the time with those of their human members. Corporations compete and co-evolve within the marketplace. They adapt. Today's corporations are far more specialised than those of 100 years ago. And as part of this, there's an evolutionary arms race underway among the corporations. It's very similar to the one that saw our mammalian ancestors evolve a theory of mind, a mechanism for modelling the internal processes of other organisms, which was necessary in order to hunt effectively smart, hot-blooded, big-brained creatures like themselves. The creature with the best theory of mind won, which is part of a reason why big cats have much bigger brains than their dinosaur predecessors. They need them to outthink the relatively big-brained prey. Corporate evolution is selecting for entities which are ever more heavily automated in pursuit of their general goals. This, I think, is axiomatic. And our understanding of these entities is almost certainly mistaken, because all we have to go by is their history as collective enterprises of human workers. But in the future, they may not simply be understood as a group of ordinary humans. This is in turn providing feedback, the evolution of the corporations, their selection, to reward corporations who provide automation tools, including much of what used to be termed artificial intelligence in previous decades. For example, machine vision, expert systems, networking, and speech processing. And finally, the one point which I think it should be obvious is we humans were at a disadvantage in trying to compete, given the competitive advantage of the intellectual automata we've already unleashed, which we're competing with as if they're other humans, or at least equals. Now, this has sort of dragged me into somewhat treacherous waters. It's been a very contrarian and negative description of the modern corporation. I'm not going to stop and suddenly and sing the praises of international capitalism. There's a sufficiently vocal chorus out there already without me adding to it. But I felt that the important point of a modern automated corporation, the artificial intelligences among us, if you like, is that their central drive appears to be the universal application of property right law to raw ideas, the manufacture of artificial scarcity by promoting the concept of intellectual property. Intellectual property is a paradox. Unlike physical goods, ideas aren't redistributed, but duplicated. When I give you an idea, I still have that idea in my own head. I'm not deleting it from myself and passing it along. The cost of information storage and bandwidth is vanishingly small compared to the cost of, for example, duplicating physical artifacts. Copyright as a concept has its roots in the technology of making physical artifacts, books, objects, when issues of physical supply made it possible to impose a bottleneck on the physical objects and hence the distribution of ideas. But the generalization of copyright, which we've seen over the past decades, towards general ownership rights for a whole range of informational goods, becomes increasingly tenuous the more far-reaching the coverage is meant to be. When we have the concept of a record album recorded on vinyl, and no easy way of duplicating it without a large pressing plant, the concept of perhaps extending copyright to cover recordings doesn't seem as outrageous as it might have back in the 19th century. But when the music in question is just a stream of bits which can be transmitted in a myriad of ways, you've got to question just what is being achieved by attempting to treat the bit stream as something over which copy control can be exerted. Now, in strict contrast of a proprietarian perspective on creativity, which says that I own my ideas and you owe me money every time you use them, and that'll be €5 from all of you for that sentence, please, there's the open source or software libre approach, the re-establishment of the commons. The free software movement, whose ideology was explicitly framed by Richard Stallman at MIT in the 1980s, has now spread to the point where large corporations, notably IBM and Novell, are seeing it as rather useful to them, despite their primary motive being the acquisition of an exertion of property rights over intellectual property. They've found free software and free information invaluable in making an end run around that most 20th century of predators, Microsoft. There's nothing inevitable about us living in an informational panopticon in which all information is owned by someone and every letter has its price, or about us living in a world of free software and free creative arts and the creative commons. It's still a debatable land over which battle is raging. Over the past 10 decades, the commons have been steadily encroached on by corporate predators, and corporations that can impose bottlenecks of scarcity on the distribution of goods and services can levy a tax on traffic and make huge profits. This is, after all, how wholesale distributors work, and it's how the large-scale media industry works. But if the incremental cost of copying data is zero, there can't be an actual physical bottleneck. So an artificial state of scarcity can only exist as long as it's manufactured. That's why the concept of intellectual property is so vehemently promoted by large companies, and in particular the media, broadcasting and publishing industries. Now I've rambled over to the concept of the media and broadcasting industries, I feel like asking, can we envisage a future or futures which aren't dominated by artificially generated scarcity or by feral corporate superorganisms? These are the pressing facts we live with in the world today, and our creative fictions project today's concerns on the blank screen of the uncertain future. Except, I should add, in the case of Neal Stephenson, who at great length and in extreme depth is exporting these themes by exploring the historical era in which their evolutionary roots lay. It's no accident that the dominant futuristic paradigm of cyberpunk fiction, a format intimately anchored in the 1980s, is a deracinated dog-eat-dog world dominated by corporate predators. Neither is it an accident that Ian Banks launched the first big counterblast of the period, a depiction of a society of complete plenty in which money was seen as a symptom of poverty. Ian is a native of Scotland, that part of the United Kingdom that's sometimes referred to as the People's Republic. So there is definitely a debate going on here within the science fictional field, and the issues do hinge on the nature of a corporation, on the concept of intellectual property, and on the future we're building for ourselves to live in. Can artists, authors, and programmers live without intellectual property or work without it? Well, now there's an open question. I've spent the past 5 years working on an attempt to answer the fictional side of the issue in the form of a series of stories, collectively titled Accelerando, or Accelerando if you pronounce it in proper Italian, although nobody does, and also a fix-up novel derived from the same source. Accelerando is a fable of the 21st century, starting with the white heat of a post-human technology boom and moving steadily faster, until halfway through it, we collide with a conceptual brick wall of a Werner Vinge-style singularity, the logical point beyond which extrapolation fails, for we have developed transhuman intelligences which are now driving the pace of change, and which attempts to explore some of the issues of the human condition beyond the singularity. I started writing Accelerando with one story, Lobsters, in mid-1999. Lobsters almost wrote itself in a fit of desperation. At that time, I was working for a dot-com startup venture under tremendous pressure. I was the lead programmer, and we were due to go public in less than 9 months. My to-do list at that point was 4 years deep. Business was growing at a compound rate of 30% per month. I found myself sitting in a bar in Amsterdam one rainy weekend, wondering if there was a way to organise things differently, wishing things were better. Was it possible to experience time at a normal human rate again, instead of accelerated by at least a factor of 5? We used to talk jokingly about web years. A subjective year on the web, in the web business during the boom period, was equivalent to about 2.5 months in the real world, and that went for fatigue as well as for work. It seemed to me that we were entering a phase in which the running was no longer being made by human beings, but by an intricate network of automata that we had created, the corporate intelligences and the environment in which the dot-com business was being generated. It wasn't necessarily desirable, however plausible many of the side effects might have appeared. Naively, it seemed that if we could just break the link between the intellectual property scarcity that had been manufactured and the products themselves, we might be standing on the verge of a new era of total information affluence, at least in software and information. Lobsters started out as the story of Manfred, a quasi-extropian American exile in Europe with big personal and political issues. Manfred is an entrepreneur in a post-scarcity society that is struggling to be born. He has good ideas and gives them away to whoever can make best use of them. His life is a potlatch, a society of gift-giving in which you compete not to take as much from the commonweal as possible, but to demonstrate your worth by the size of the gifts that you give people. He's so productive that he's never at a loss for an airline ticket or a hotel room, courtesy of his admiring beneficiaries. Of course, he's got other problems, notably his fiancée, an IRS auditor who doesn't believe in free lunches, and his pet robot cat, which has its own theories about what Manfred ought to be doing. But it's hard to have a good story without a source of conflict, whether ideological or physical, and in treating the ideas of a society of plenty and a Vingian singularity in SF, I was forced to hunt for new ways to highlight the philosophical conflicts in these stories without turning them into a series of boring monologues. The traditional source of conflict, find an enemy alien with the wrong colour skin and beat up on it, seems slightly lacking. Like all good stories, Lobsters didn't want to end. I began writing a sequel to follow it through, and realised halfway in that I was actually working on a trilogy of trilogies of novelettes. A complete story arc covering 3 generations of post-humans, genetically linked, but so alien in mind from one generation to the next as to be almost irreconcilable. Along the way, the corporations came to life, clearly, and not only strangled an entire human civilization, but gutted a galaxy. Once the emergent intelligences became independent of human hosts in whose minds they ran, there's room for human beings to at least search for a way out. Things are grim, but they're not inevitably so, at least in this particular work of fiction. The Accelerando stories were published in Asimov's SF magazine in the US, finishing last month. The novel is due out next July. Along the way, they were nominated for the Hugo Nebula Awards and a few others, somewhat to my surprise, because the first friend I showed the stories to said, "This is great, but to understand it, the readers would have to have overdosed on Wired for 6 months. Wired is the fetish magazine of the American dot-com enthusiasts. Well, it turns out that rather more people than anyone expected have overdosed on Wired. The future has a curious way of creeping up on us faster than we expected. Whether we succeed in grabbing control of it, in taking it back from the corporate intelligences who've been creating it since the 18th century, is another matter. But we can continue to speculate about other ways of organising things, different attitudes to intellectual property, for example, and who knows, ideas have got a way of spreading. And that's it for now.